Now I want to come to the lion form. Here is the lion pouncing on the cow, or on the bull in this case. The sun pounces on the moon. The lion pounces on the bull. Equivalent symbol is the eagle pouncing on the serpent. Moon shedding his shadow, serpent shedding his skin, eagle the solar bird, lion the solar animal. There she is, mother lion, the southern lion as a powerful goddess. This is 3200 BC from Sumer, S-U-M-E-R, the earliest high civilization in the world. This is for me an enormously important and impressive figure. This is the bull. The sacred beard indicates a ceremonial and symbolic animal with the bull's horns. It is being consumed by the lion eagle. This lion bird is a Sumerian representation of the solar power constantly consuming the bull, and who cares, you know? Life comes, life goes on. This foot is on a crescent form here on the top of the cosmic mountain. The cosmic mountain is the earth goddess. Here is the generating power of the bull. Now, you remember those flints that appeared in the Navajo representing energy and power? This is the same kind of motif from the joints of the bull. It's a wonderful piece. 3200 BC, ancient Sumer. This is from Babylon, a serpent Madonna. Now, when this was first discovered in the 20s, it was thought perhaps to be a foreview of the fall in the Garden of Eden in the biblical tradition, because the book of Genesis, the mythology in the book of Genesis, is largely an adaptation of Sumero-Babylonian myths. But it's a very different spirit here. This is the cosmic tree, the axial tree. Here is the goddess of the tree. And here is the serpent who sheds its skin to be born again. The association of goddess, serpent, and tree, such as we get to see in the tree in the Garden of Eden, Eve, and the serpent. And here comes the male moon figure for refreshment. Comes here to receive the fruit of eternal life for refreshment. This is not a fall. There's no idea of a fall in these traditions. And in India, the deity enters the world voluntarily as a dance. The world is a play. Leela is a game. And that's the mood you have in these mythologies. It's joyous, humorous at least. There's no more dreary mythology in the world than that of the Old Testament. Now, this is called the Warka vase. It's from Uruk and from the same period that we're talking about. Explode it, and you get this form. A king, unfortunately the vase is broken here, so we don't see him, but we do see his train and a servant carrying it, 3200 BC. These are motifs that come down the line. And here is a servant before him, a priest, bringing offerings to the priestess of the temple. Here, these forms in early Mesopotamia represent the temple door. It's a standard motif. And within the temple are offerings that have been brought. Here are the Sumerian priests bringing the offerings. The priests go before the shrine naked. We go before God naked. And these are the flocks, the sheep and goats and so forth, who are to be increased through these offerings. Remember the little Paleolithic figure where I said we have the woman now as muse, as inspirer of the spiritual life. This is the first thing of this delicacy and sweetness that we have in the history, I think, of sculpture. The eyes originally would have had blue lapis lazuli forms in there. There would have been a wig on the figure, and this is woman as muse. When we think now of mother cults and so forth, everybody's talking about fertility and all that, but that's not the main inspiration of the goddess. That's only on the physical level. But on the spiritual level, she's the mother of our spiritual birth as well, the virgin birth, the birth of our spiritual life. And that certainly was represented here. This, I think, one of the most beautiful things from this whole period. Now, other representations of the goddess and God in this aspect lack the delicacy of this, but they tell us something of the accent. These are called eye goddesses, the eye goddess. The accent up here in the spiritual realm, and the blue eyes, the eyes of the heavens. There is Abu, the male deity in this tradition. Here we can see the blue eyes. And the face here is quite specifically a Semitic face. And so the Semites are coming in from the desert. People of the Akkad and the Moabites and these ones and those ones and the Amorites and so forth pouring in and becoming assimilated. There is an eye goddess shrine, just the eyes. Now we come to 2350 BC, Sargon the First. This is the first known, important Semitic emperor in this zone. These people have come in from the Syro-Arabian desert. They come in as conquerors and then as rulers. His date, 2350 BC. Now the story of Sargon, he was born of a humble mother in the upper reaches of the river, the Tigris. And she put him in a little basket of rushes that had been made watertight by pitch and confided him to the waters of the river. And he floated down the river and was pulled out of the river by a gardener on the royal estate. And the goddess loved him, and so he advanced in rank and presently became the ruler himself. Have you heard anything like that story ever before? This is, of course, just about 2,000 years earlier than the text with which you're familiar. He is the first conqueror for whom we have praise and celebrations of victory. It is at about this time that wars of conquest come into being. Formerly, wars were simply revenge wars or ceremonial wars like the one I showed in New Guinea. And a village would be raided and that was it. But now we have substantial conquest and we have hymns and celebrations celebrating these conquests, tearing down and annihilating the cities, and a refrain that comes back, and we washed our weapons in the sea, and we washed our weapons in the sea. So here it is, about 2400 BC, the beginnings of the kind of war that have been distinctive of our world of civilization ever since. And ruthless. Annihilation of the whole population. Just read the book of Judges. Read the book of Joshua. And you get plenty of it. Here is a reconstruction of the ziggurat of Ur. Date 2000 BC. There was a Sumerian period, the early one, 3500 BC or so. Then a Semitic invasion with Sargon the First, and then a Sumerian restoration and resurgence about 2000 BC. And most of what we know about the mythology and architecture of ancient Sumer dates from this Ur number 3, and Lagash periods, 2000 BC. What you have here are stages of elevation, and the lower manifestation of the deity will be shown to the people down here, but up here, where heaven and earth are married, you would have the esoteric cult of the priesthood, and then the ascent. Same thing in Guatemala and Mexico. This now is the ziggurat of Ur, as it was photographed in the 1920s. And Sir Leonard Woolley, excavating in these grounds, came upon the most amazing burials. Whole courts that had been buried alive. These are known as the royal tombs of Ur. Here is a reconstruction at the University of Chicago Museum of one of the great tombs at Ur. This is the king's burial. Now, whether he was killed or died a natural death, we do not know. Or whether he was a king, actually, or just a high priest king who became then a sacrificial offering, we do not know. Here are the bullock carts that brought the body in and so forth. All of the bullock cart drivers, these are the officers of the court, and these are the girl dancers and musicians. The hands of the harpists, the skeleton hands, were at that place on the harp where the strings would have been had they not decayed. There were two orders of women in this grave. One wore gold headbands, and the other wore silver. One of those wearing silver was found not to have the headband on her skull, but it was all wrapped up and at her hip. She had been late for the party and had not had time to put her crown on. Then, above this tomb of the king, was another burial of the queen. So it's a sati burial in high style. Her court along with her. The figures lying down there in regular rows, and many of them with a little cup at the side in which there had been probably henbane or something of the sort to put the person to sleep while they were buried. Now this business of mass burial, whole courts buried, continued in the Near East into very late times. The early dynasties of Egypt are full of this. And in China, it was continued until the time of Confucius and Mozart. Both Confucius and Mozart mentioned this as something abominable that should not continue. This is known as the Banner of Ur. It is the representation of the first military expedition, professional soldiers. Here they go. And these are the earliest pictures of chariots that we have, war chariots. The wheels did not revolve on the axles. The axle revolved with the wheel, and so they were very clumsy chariots. The animals pulling them were not horses, but wild asses. The brilliant horse-drawn war chariot comes much later. And here, then, is the victory feast of the Patesi, the principal governor, and his court, drinking probably a beer or mead. These were not wine drinkers. And here are the cattle being brought in for the feast. Now, behind this figure here, there is a figure standing with the harp. And on the harp's head, we see the figure of the bull. This is a reconstruction of the harp. We have hymns from this period of the bull god, the moon god, Dumuzi, who has gone into the underworld and sings for his goddess to come and bring them both to eternal life. And the great hero deed of the goddess is the descent, stage by stage, to the underworld to bring eternal life to both. This is the ideal of sati. The husband and wife are one. When he dies or is sacrificed, she must follow, and the two together are then brought to eternity through her heroic act. This is just about the earliest example we have of animal fable. You can see the animal fable quality here, the animals playing human parts, they're enacting sacrifices and music, dances, and so forth here. Now we come to about 1750 BC, and this is Hammurabi. Hammurabi of Babylon. It's from his period that the great epic of Gilgamesh comes. Here is Hammurabi receiving the law from the god Shamash, the sun god. You see the sun rays from his shoulders. As Moses received the law from Yahweh, so Hammurabi from Shamash. And when the law comes with that kind of a backing, it can't be fooled around with. The law is, of course, invented by Hammurabi, but attributed to God. And we can say the same for Moses.
Embracing the goddess as their deity, the people of early civilizations lived in accord with the natural world. To illustrate the Neolithic idea of the universal rhythms of life, Campbell tells a curious tale of the nature and numbers of the cosmos.
Now, there's a basic mythological idea about the cosmos that underlies all of these cultures. And it underlies even the systems that came very much later in Iron Age times. And I just want to tell a little story about the nature of this. When we come to the Indian mythology of India, which carries right into the present the implications of the old Bronze Age, we find that a cycle of time endures for 432,000 years. This is the yuga. And then you get up to the Maha Yuga, the great yuga or cycle within which the other cycles proceed, and you get 4,320,000. Now, I was reading one day in the Poetic Edda of Iceland, which dates from about the 12th century, 11th, 12th centuries. And in the Grimnismal, I learn that in the warrior hall of Votan, or Odin, to which the warriors are taken after death, there are 540 doors. And at the end of the cycle of time, in what's called the Day of the Wolf, 800 warriors will go through each of those doors to give battle to the anti-gods in a mutual annihilation, and that will be the end of the world. And then it'll come back again for another round. Now, 540 times 800 is 43,200. So you get the same number in Iceland in the 12th century that you get in the Puranas of India. Well, I thought, how come? Well, about 10 years later, I learned that Berossos, who was a Chaldean priest writing in Greek in the 3rd century BC, had given an account of Babylonian mythology, the mythology of the creation and the coming flood. This is the mythology out of which the book of Genesis is built. And there we learn that from the time of the first city, the city of Kish, to the coming of the flood of Utnapishtim, Utnapishtim is the Babylonian Noah, 432,000 years elapsed. That's the same non-number. So here we are in the Mesopotamian area, which is right between India and the Icelandic people, and it would seem reasonable to think that there was some kind of relationship. Then I learned there that 10 kings ruled during that period. Well, that's a long-lived king who would have been one member of 10 during a period of 432,000 years. So I thought, well, I wonder where I would find long lives like that elsewhere. And I thought of Methuselah, so I turned to the book of Genesis. How many patriarchs, counting from Adam to Noah? 10. Well, well. How many years? Well, so-and-so is so old when he begets so-and-so. And I ran through the begat chapter, and in the version that I was reading, it adds up to 1,656 years. Well, I'm no mathematician, and so although I was in a panic of excitement, I couldn't factor 1,656 into 432,000. So I thought, well, some German certainly has worked this out. And I thought, who would it have been? And I went to Jeremias and was reading along. He's a really great, great Babylonian scholar. And I begin to get the smell of this thing. Then I see a footnote reference to a Jewish Assyriologist who had read a paper to the Göttingen Society for Geisteswissenschaften in 1873 on numbers in the Old Testament. So guess how many seven-day weeks there are in that number of years? It's 86,400, which is just twice 43,200. Now, all of these numbers that I've given you, 16, 56, and so forth, if you add them up, they come out to 9. This is the great number of the goddess. Well, all that was very interesting. Then I thought, let me see, astronomically, how many years it takes for a complete precession of the equinoxes. We're going into the Aquarian age, out of the Piscean, and before that, the Aries, before that, the Taurian, and so forth. How many years before we have a complete cycle of the equinoxes? And the answer is 25,920. This is a astronomical fact. Divide that by 60, the source, the sexagesimal base, and you get 432. So we have the big cycles of time, and we have the biblical tradition, and all right out of this Bronze Age, which has to have been based on actual observation. That's very, very interesting. So one fine day, I receive a book on how many laps you have to swim in order to stay alive. Well, this is by Colonel Cooper, or Major Cooper, and it's called Aerobics. And a footnote, page 101 or some place around there, I read that a man in perfect physical condition at rest has a heartbeat of approximately 1 beat a second, 60 seconds a minute, so forth and so on. How many heartbeats do you suppose in 12 hours? 43,200. So, it's the rhythm of our own heartbeat. It's the rhythm of the universe. We are in accord with the universal rhythm. Now, when I was in India, I went to a great temple in Kanjivaram, temple of the goddess, and the shrine was a symbolization of the womb of the goddess. And we brought fruits to the priest as offering, and he then took the powder that the women put on their foreheads, this red powder, and dusted it into the altar, reciting the 108 names of the goddess. Divide 432 by 4 and you get 108. And at the New Year's Day, the New Year's night, 108 ringings of the gong as given. 108 times 4 is 432. You recite your 108 names at noon, at sundown, at midnight, and at dawn. 1 and 8 make 9. If you live near a Catholic church that's still functioning, you'll hear the Angelus ring. And the Angelus rings 9, and then 9 again. That's 18 and so forth. 8 and 1 and 9. This is the same number in another inflection, and it's come to us this way, and it's the number of the goddess. Everything in the universe is obeying its law, its dharma, its duty. The sun gets up on time to perform its day. The trees live according to their dharma. So, in performing your social duty, your dharma, you are supporting the universe. And the word dharma comes from a root dhri, which means support. Everyone is supporting the universe by being in accord with the rhythm of the goddess's number, you might say.